Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're here, and you're there, and if you'd like to give us a call to do question or discuss or something.
We're making an assumption that they're there.
Well, you know, everybody who isn't here is there.
If you are listening to us, then you are there, and that's our assumption. The
and if
real
you're
assumption
not listening
is
to us, then you're not there.
Right. The assumption is that you're actually listening to us.
But, you know, if we did a survey, if we were like the Federal Reserve and we did a careful survey, mm-hmm. and we'd say, are you there, are you here? And they would all say, I'm here.
I did a survey in my house yesterday.
You did?
Yeah. I got no response because I was alone. But
now, wait a minute. You could not have been alone in your house.
I was at that moment.
Was Jacques not there?
He was not in the house at the time.
Okay.
My cats were out of the house. The dog was out of the house.
Bella was out of the house?
Yeah. And
so you were alone in the house.
I did a survey, and I had no responses. It was
Mm-hmm. Well, this could be serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a significant drop.
You could have self-responded.
Yeah, it was a significant drop in the survey rate, so I don't know what this means for the GDP.
I don't either. You could really be an economist.
Right,
gentlemen.
Right. On the other hand.
So, what were we talking about? 773-1400 is the telephone number to call in here if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise?
1-866-597-1400.
We'll have some good news. Foreclosure starts. I love that. Foreclosure starts. Hit pre-crisis low. The number of houses that in the last month to enter foreclosure, where the foreclosure process was begun, is now down to the same level it was in 2007, which is to say not.
It's very, very, very tiny.
Okay. There's still a lot of them processing through the system because in those states where judicial approval is required prior to foreclosure.
It's taken a long time.
And the banks are having a heck of a time coming up with all the documents to prove that they actually own the loan.
Right. That weren't signed by a robot.
Yes. Are signed by somebody who was already dead at the time or something
right.
like that. Anyway.
Well, it's a good skill if you can learn to sign something after you're dead. It's a good skill to have. You can be
post-mortem derivatives.
Right. You can be in high demand well past your date of retirement.
Right. And, you know, it's actually far more efficient that way. But the lawyers like it because in those states there's a lot of lawyers kept very, very busy trying to prove the obvious.
The derivatives market is the full employment for lawyers market.
Right. I completely understand that. Anyway, but one of the things that's not happening in the United States, and one of the reasons our recovery has been relatively slow, and one of the reasons that overall the job market, if you look at the quality, quantity, and all the other stuff, and we mingle it together, and we say, okay, how's the labor market doing in the United States? How is the ability to get a job and get good pay in the United States compared to where it was, let's say, in 2006? And the answer is we're about 80% recovered, which accounts for that one-third of the people who feel like they're worse off. And when I say 80% recovered, we're talking about if you look at the people who are working and the people who want to work and you lump them all together and say how successful are they being at A, finding work, and B, being satisfied with the work that they have as paying them what they expect to be paid. And you measure that in 2006, you see, and here's a number, and we're about up to 80% of that now, and there's a very good reason for that.
Yeah, let me step in here and say, make it a little more complicated or less, depending on how you look at it. Because what you just said was that the overall market, it is not as good, or the overall populace is not as good as it was before.
We're only looking at the people who, A, are working, or B, want to work.
Right.
Okay? And we're not taking into account that the job participation rate has fallen off or anything. We're just simply saying, of those people who would like to work, including those who are working, let's measure how well they perceive and financially how well they are doing. And the answer is we're about 80% recovered.
Right. Okay. So having said that, 80% recovered.
Right.
I'm going to make it either more simple or more complex, depending on which way you
look at
it.
Knowing you, I think it's about to get more complex.
Oh, boy. All right. The participation rate, the percentage of people who want to work that are not working. Basically.
No, no. I want to disagree with you. The participation rate is the number of people who could work, but it has fallen because there's a lot of people who don't want to work because a lot of them have retired.
Right. Okay. Well, it goes the same way. The viewpoint here is about the same. So if you take a room full of people, and this is what I'm getting at here, there's a room full of people, 2007. This room full of people is working. If you look at our GDP, we're making more money in the economy today than we were then. So as far as the economy is concerned, we're fully recovered, more than fully recovered. We're actually way up above what we were. But if you're sitting in a room full of people and you were working in 2007, you're about 80% recovered because there's more people in the room now. People have been coming in and other people have been leaving. If you're sitting in the room, this is where macro and microeconomics come in. Because when we talk about GDP, we can say the market is the economy, any measurement that we look at, the big area, it's fully recovered. And then what you're saying is also absolutely true. A person is likely, on average, to be about 80% recovered. Anyway, that was my complication or simplification.
We have about... we can mix our metaphors and our statistics here, but basically we're about 80% of the way to the income of the working population that we had in 2006, which explains part of why there's this sense that we aren't recovered yet, because there's still a lot of people who would like to have better jobs. There were back in 2006 too, but the level of at which people had gotten up to the point where, okay, I'm really quite satisfied with my job, is much lower. Now, there's a reason for that. We have talked in the past about the largest multiplier in the economy, and there we get into derivatives very quickly, is a custom house, and the second largest, and as far as the quantity of multiplying that goes on.
Right.
The overall, a really big part of the United States post-World War II economy growth has been the manufacture and sale of new houses. And we've had a steadily, up until 2007, we had a pretty steadily rising percentage of Americans who were living in a house they at least nominally owned. Well, of course, to get a lot of people in houses, we had to build a lot of houses.
Right.
And when we build houses, we employ a lot of people. And we got a problem with that right now. It's really a fascinating problem because there's two different aspects to it. The biggest one just sort of popped up recently as the Federal Reserve was digging around in these statistics, and they made an interesting discovery. Obviously, the banks seem to be much more restrictive in offering mortgages than they were in the past. Despite the fact that there are lots of guarantees and the banks are being encouraged to make to give out more mortgages to get the economy getting started, they realized they went too far in restricting the bank's abilities to issue mortgages, and a lot of things have gone on. But here's when they went to the banks and say, you're not issuing as many mortgages as you used to, despite the fact that we're encouraging you to issue mortgages, they went down through the numbers and they made an astonishing discovery, which is so obvious, it's hard to imagine how we missed it. We have been talking about the huge accumulation of student debt in the United States over the past several years. It's been accumulating for some time. Here's the problem. You got a couple of people who otherwise would easily qualify for a mortgage because they've got good jobs, they've got good income, everything's really cool, and then they take a look at the mountain of student debt this professional couple has and realize that their total student debt payments are so large they really can't afford a mortgage. Or even if they can afford a mortgage right now, if one of them loses their job,
they're back.
They're going to default.
Right. So that's what we...
And what I'm trying to say is the student loan avalanche is affecting the economic recovery hugely because we can't build houses. And there's a second problem, too, but you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, this is important, and that is we call this the household formation rate. That's how we can track to see what percentage of an age group is living with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what you're talking about. And part of that, you know,
what percentage of the graduates are living with?
Well, let's go back a second. There's three groups that are being tracked. There's the 18 to 24 year old group,
mm-hmm.
and that typically has a much lower percentage living with the parents from 18 to 24 because you've got college involved there.
Right.
People want to move out. They mm-hmm. tend to move back in. That seems to be a very, very apparent here. What happened in 2007 is about 8% were living with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning of 2014, about 16% are living with their parents.
What percentage of the – have you got a college graduate?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't separate by college graduate. But the 25 to 29-year-olds –
mm-hmm.
Right now,
that's the college. That was
that'd be the college graduate right. years.
What percentage of
at the peak of the market in 2007, it was about 16% were living with their parents. Uh-huh. Well, now it's closer to 20.
Now that can I?
That's a big one. And then there's one more. This is one that fits directly in with what you're talking about.
So you
about.
Got roughly 20% of the college graduate age people living
right.
with their parents.
Well, then you got the 30 to 34 year old group.
Oh, that's going to be interesting.
They were down at about 7% in 2007,
right.
and they're now at 10%.
Okay.
And that's the key group that we're talking about. These are the people that should be out. They should be, at this point, living elsewhere. But that 3% jump right there, the new household formations, they're building up money. They're paying off student debt, but they're also building up money because they have been living with their parents for a long time. That 18 to 24-year-old group has had a significant drop in people living with their parents in the last year.
Right.
We're talking about from an 18% down to a 16%. That doesn't seem like a lot, 2%. It's huge. That is a massive outflow of people from houses into new places. Now, they're generally going to apartments at that age, which is why we're seeing rents actually rising when mortgage rates are falling.
Yeah, but let me throw a little thing in there that I didn't even know I was going to talk about, but I've read an article on it. One-third, 33%, of Chinese graduates from college in China
live at home.
Are living with
their parents.
And not only living with, but dependent upon their parents. We got 20. And I don't know that that's college graduate.
That's
the age group. And I suspect we're going to find that about 20% of college graduates are living with their parents. I think that's probably going to fit in there. And about 33% of China. This is one of those really weird things. And I'm going to get back to the other reason that housing starts we've got a problem with housing starts right now. But I want to point out something that happens historically that is really big. And if you want to, there's a book on it, and I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, The Great Wave.
David Hackett Fisher.
David Hackett Fisher, Great Wave Pricing Rhythms in the Flow of History.
Right. Well
got
done.
It right.
Well
yes.
done.
I always want to say revolutions, rhythms in the flow of history. He talks about the fact that when these great socioeconomic collapses occurred in the West, which were in the 1600s, in the 1300s, in the 1600s, and he predicts one in the 21st century here in the 2000s. And it is definitely hovering around out there. They also occurred in China.
Yep.
Even though the two economies were almost totally unlinked. And that is what got to be. He literally says sunspots may have something to do with it in there, okay? But the weather and a lot. The reason I want to point this out. There's a lot of good news coming out of China right now, one of which is we really thought they were going to collapse into a recession with their housing collapse and all kinds of things. And, in fact, their market is up dramatically recently, and they seem to be recovering very nicely in their economy. Yay.
Yay. Yeah, we don't want them to collapse.
But it's fascinating that they're having the same postgraduate issues that we are at the same time for total it's really hard to find a connection except the fact it's just happening.
People.
Now let me, if I could, I want to go on to the why I want to touch on this. Why the second problem in A, mortgages, and B, housing starts, is that around the country, construction companies are reporting they are having a great deal of difficulty finding skilled labor.
Right.
Meaning they want to find somebody who will show up for work and be able to operate the tools necessary to do the high-tech, high-productivity work on a house, which is outside in the heat and being pretty miserable.
Right. And what's happened is over the past 4 or 5 years, those highly skilled people haven't had a job in construction, so they've gone on to be highly skilled somewhere else.
Well, they said there's two problems. A, they've gone on to other places. B, a lot of them apparently weren't legally documented.
Right.
Framers, for example, is the major shortage is people who can frame a house. And apparently, even though we have reduced housing starts, and a lot of them, by the way, now are working. This is fascinating. Do you know where they're working?
Construction sites.
No. Make a guess.
Think manufacturing about it. Facilities.
Where is the lowest unemployment in the country right now?
Texas.
No. North Dakota.
North Dakota. They were. Oh, well, right. Yeah.
Like a fraction of a percent.
Yeah. They're working, up there on the oil.
Working in the fracking oil fields. We can say fracking on the air. So.
Right. Yeah. Technical term.
Yes. Right. And basically, you know, I slapped myself in the head when I said this, which when I read this, because
it's kind of funny watching him walk down the hallway and start slapping himself.
We have in the village of Salado, a fellow who is noted for being a good handyman. He has a good crew, and they've always been very reliable. The guys who used to show up from his crew when we needed some minor construction work done or a tree taken down in such a manner that it didn't crush everything around it are gone. He's got a new set of people there. And I said, what? And he's got a bunch of young people who, you know, they're very enthusiastic and they're good, but they require a lot more supervision. And I asked him, what happened to these guys? He said, they all went to the oil fields.
Right.
And it suddenly hit me when I was reading this report from the Federal Reserve. Oh, yeah, it's been right in front of me the whole time. You know, these guys are making a lot of money in the oil field. So this is what I'm trying to say. Is that when something happens and you say, okay, that's going on way over there and it won't have any effect on me here.
It does.
It does have an effect. It has an effect on the entire economy. And one of the reasons our economy is doing so well is we're producing a lot of oil suddenly that we weren't producing before.
Right.
And we're drilling for a lot of oil that we weren't drilling before. But construction is hurting. And even if we got rid of the student loan problem.
Right.
And even if the banks were to open up and start lending money again. You still couldn't get a lot of new houses started because the skilled people, now I'm not talking about the knuckle-draggers who...
I wouldn't go so far as to call them knuckle-draggers.
Well, they drag knuckles around probably, you know.
Oh, right. Well, those very long arms then.
Yes, but the people who are low-end labor, they're not having a lot of trouble finding the people who say, carry this bucket of stuff from here to there. But they are having a great deal of difficulty finding the people who can actually, and framing a house, believe it or not, folks.
It's difficult.
It's something you want to do right.
Yeah. if you want the doors to swing properly, then the walls have to actually be straight up and down. They can't be slightly angled.
And those same people are now scattered around the country wherever the oil patch is drilling for oil.
Yeah. And they're getting paid a lot more doing that than they were in the construction area.
So we actually are running into skilled labor shortages. This is the fascinating thing to me. We're running into skilled labor shortages in building houses and building, because a lot of them, by the way, is also commercial construction is doing pretty well.
Right.
While college-educated people, 20% of them, once they get their education, can't find a job. Now, there's something to do with some very deep wisdom and understanding there, and I haven't quite figured out what it is.
Well, I think we should play some commercials.
Why?
Because the studio lights need to stay on, and we need to have
picky,
electricity.
Picky. Okay.
You know,
we'll do it.
Indoor plumbing is nice.
But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to give us a call to make comments about any of this silliness we've been talking about or ask any questions about anything economic or financial, 773-1400 is the number in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
Lord willing and the creek don't rise, we'll be back. We'll be right back. back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. We only have about half an hour left in our entire program today.
Really?
Yeah, and this is generally when people actually say, oh, I better ask a question before they get off the air. They've been talking about such really boring things that we haven't been calling it. I get emails saying, I don't want to interrupt you guys. I know what's going on. They're falling asleep. We're putting them to sleep.
Yeah, and then they wake up at this point.
And then they go, oh, I better ask a question.
Well, there's an article in Barron's that falls into the I told you so category, and I love I told you so articles. The headline is High Yield Bonds Land in the Junk Pile.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Huh.
The thing we've been predicting. And the funny thing is nobody can figure out why at this point.
I can figure out why. Why at this point, another point I can't figure out. But I can figure out why it happened.
Apparently last week investors pulled $7.1 billion from high yield mutual funds and exchange traded funds. And that's the single largest outflow from such funds ever in history, and it seems to be accelerating.
Yeah, just to give a piece of information, a comparison, because when we start talking about billions or trillions, it's big, and it's too big for us to comprehend. Our national trade deficit, the difference between what we import and export, is really, really big. This little section of time, you go back 1 year, our deficit is slightly larger by $4 billion. Okay, so the difference in our entire national import and export changed over 1 year by $4 billion. That's what we're talking about, the big world out there. $7 billion just left high yield.
Mm-hmm.
That's twice the change in our import-export difference.
And this is kind of a, if you will, a shot across the bow or something similar, a warning of what we have been warning you of, and hopefully...
A warning about a warning.
Yeah, this is the first indication that what we were warning of is beginning to take place, which is people in very, very low interest rate environments, and we're definitely in a very, very low interest rate environment, have a tendency to reach for higher yields and to get them wherever they can. And once they start getting the higher yield, they tend to sit back and relax and not worry about it. Well, the professionals are bailing out of the high yield area right now. And that is an indication that things probably will get a lot worse in the future. I have no clue why they chose this moment, but there was kind of a rush for the exits, and the rush for the exit was largely by the more or less professional investors. I have another subject too, but you got something?
You go right ahead.
Okay. I want to talk about, we got a question from our one caller today about derivatives.
Right.
And I want to tell you probably the biggest derivative out there that masquerades as something else from the perspective of an investor are ETFs. ETFs are not actual ownership in shares of corporations.
No.
And they are very, very, very complex derivatives.
I don't know that they're very, very complex. Any derivative is very, very complex.
Well,
it's just a derivative.
Usually I can take a derivative back to its original, what it's covering, and understand it if it's a simple derivative. But the problem is that basically ETFs are derivatives of derivatives of derivatives of derivatives issued by a company that either buys or sells them or doesn't, as the case may be, from day to day. And they are not, unlike mutual funds, a partial ownership in a portfolio of stocks and bonds. A mutual fund is literally, if there's 100 shares of a mutual fund issued and there's so many dollars of stocks and bonds in the portfolio, then you have 1% of the stocks and bonds. So it's pretty direct.
Right.
Whereas ETFs are pretty weird.
Yeah, you can let me kind of smooth that out a little bit, because I think there are some wrinkles in the explanation there. A mutual fund, a typical open-ended mutual fund, you own a piece of the mutual fund, and it's the value of the mutual fund is net asset value. It takes all the assets out there and adds them up, and you own a percentage of that. You own a share of that. An ETF might still have that net assets underneath it.
Somewhere.
Most of them, the vast majority of them, actually have investments. So that's the thing. They have investments there, have a portfolio. Some of them have people that are actively managing. Some of them are not actively managed. They just bought some stuff, and you buy into that. But
you don't actually own a piece of that portfolio.
What you own is a piece of the thing that owns the thing.
Yes. And
which is a different world.
Actually, you don't actually own a piece of the company that issued the ETF.
No, you don't own a piece of the company. You own a piece of the ETF.
They theoretically owe you some money.
Right.
And that money will vary depending on your performance. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, basically, there's a company, and the company is the management company, and it is managing the pool of assets, and the money that it gets to invest comes from purchases of the ETF. But the ETF purchases, in this case, they could get $50 from an ETF purchase and only buy $20 worth of stock with it on any given day.
Right. The issue is that a mutual fund is priced at the end of the day based on the value, let's just say it's a stock mutual, based on the value of the stocks in the portfolio, period. ETFs are market-based, which means they go up and down with supply and demand during the day when they're traded. And they may do so completely separately from the underlying portfolio of investments. And matter of fact, sometimes they have diverged wildly from the portfolio investments. Now, why do I bring this up? Because FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which means those who are over in the industrial side, which is the people who buy and sell securities, apparently has just nailed several broker-dealers, and we haven't gotten the full figures that they're going to be nailed for, because their registered representatives, who called themselves financial advisors, were selling ETFs they did not understand to the public. And when the ETFs collapsed, and by the way, they did collapse. In this case, when people went to sell them, they couldn't sell them because there weren't buyers. In other words, in an ETF, in a mutual fund, the mutual fund itself buys back the shares from you.
Yeah.
In an ETF, there has to be another buyer on the market to buy back that unit from you.
Right. And if you go to sell and nobody's there to buy, it means
the
price will drop drastically, because you say, well, I'm trying to sell this, and unless you say, I want to sell it at this price, most people don't do that with ETFs. The people with ETFs generally just say, I want to sell my ETF, like you would with a mutual fund. Mm-hmm. And when they do that, it drops through the floor.
And in some cases, they got a tiny fraction of the money they had invested. And so ETFs...
Yeah, Barron's has been doing some good articles on this several weeks. They're not going as far as we've been talking about.
Actually, I just pulled this out of a Barron article.
Well, I mean, they've been pretty silent on it over the past several years, and we've been talking about the dangers of ETFs. And so they obviously listen to our program.
The danger isn't universal. When you have a very, 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 very well-funded company, and I'll just use an example. Let's just say Vanguard, which has a bunch of money. Okay?
Lots.
And they are trading in an area that is where there's a lot of trading going on, like the S&P 500 index. When you buy, in essence, a derivative betting on whether the S&P 500 index will go up and down, which is what an ETF on the S&P 500 index is, then the chances of it not being redeemed when you go to sell it are pretty slim. And there's other problems involved with it, but that's totally beside the point. The issue here is that unless you're very sophisticated and you understand exactly what you're getting in an ETF and who backs it, and whether or not it's likely to be covered by the underlying company, then you want to be very, very cautious, because they are definitely not anything other than a derivative. And that's not to say derivatives are bad. They're not. It's just that be cautious when you go there. We occasionally, through a third party, use some degree of ETFs in some cases, but they're very, very carefully, we're very, 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 very cautious about that and make sure that there's a lot of liquidity backing up that ETF. But there have been an explosion recently of ETFs that are so complex that apparently very few people understand them. And I really believe in what Peter Lynch, and the fact that I can remember who Peter Lynch is and most of my clients can't, tells me something. Peter Lynch said, never buy anything you can't explain to a 10-year-old using a Big Chief tablet. And I cannot, in most cases, some cases I can, but in most cases I can't explain an ETF to me, much less to them. So that's just a little comment that I wanted to throw in there. Junk bonds are the same way. Anything that has a high yield on it, if you look at the interest rate that's promised by anything, if it is above that of a similarly maturing treasury security, you are taking a risk. The issue is knowing what risk you're taking and seeing if you can control that risk. If somebody said there's no risk, but we're going to pay you 4 or 5% a year, by the way, that's junk bond territory, then you can be reasonably assured that there's junk bonds in the portfolio someplace.
Right. He's bringing up junk bonds, high-yield bonds, all that stuff. I want to talk a little bit more about bonds. We've been talking about bonds as a dangerous area for the past several years, and people are saying, well, they're still doing great.
Yeah, and matter of fact, they just hit a new...
Right.
Hi.
We just had a drop
in interest rates.
And people say, you guys, you keep talking about this, you keep talking about this. This is the point in the year 2000 that we were talking about dot-com bubble. We're talking about that now in the vast majority of the bond market. And I mean the vast majority. Because interest rates are so low, most bonds are trading at a premium. And people that buy them right now, if they hold them to maturity, they're going to have a loss of money in that principal. It's going to happen. That's what premium means. It means that you're paying more than the face value of the bond. Interest rates will go up. Interest rates will go down, but right now they're about as low as they can get. I mean, they could get possibly a little bit lower, but they're not going to hit zero. And that means that we are at a point where it's not going to go down much more. It's not possible to go down much more. And most of the people that are buying and selling bonds on the market are buying and selling those bonds based on drops in interest rate. And making a little bit of profit there. Well, when the interest rate stops dropping, you're going to lose money doing the same things. People that are holding bonds for a very long period of time, they want to hold it till maturity, just make sure you're not in a premium position. It may be a good idea to sell it right now if you are, because you'll be actually, I mean, if you bought them closer to face value and they're premium now, you might be a good idea to sell it now and wait for interest rates to come up a bit. And then pay maybe, I mean, bonds are a great part of a portfolio. It's not that I'm saying that bonds are bad. I'm saying that bonds are overpriced. And I don't know how anybody could argue the opposite side of that. Bonds are in a position where if you're not careful, you can very easily lose some money here.
Yeah, and we've been warning maybe, I mean, we're usually too early in getting out of something that's overpriced, and this is another case, but... We're still
better too early than too late.
And the analysts are still saying that we're going to see a dramatic rise in interest rates in intermediate term bonds between now and the end of the year. And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but I'm going to tell you, if they're right, you're going to see a collapse in the bond market.
Either way, it's a good time to refinance your mortgage.
That was pretty interesting.
Yeah, you can make some money on that right there. If
Absolutely.
You do it that way, if you're getting money loaned to you at low interest rates, that's great. Don't loan it to people at low interest rates. That's what we're talking about.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Lamar Lewis from Temple.
Hello, Lamar Lewis von Temple.
I was just having a question. Do you really consider that the interest rates will rise with the way the Federal Reserve is handling interest rates at the moment? Realistically, I don't see them rising in the near future.
Well, unfortunately, the Federal Reserve does not have total control over interest rates. The Federal Reserve controls short-term interest rates.
Yes, sir.
The long-term interest rates are affected by quantitative easing, which is going to end in October. And at that point, the Federal Reserve effectively surrenders control over long-term interest rates, which they fully intend to do at that point. And, you know, a lot of people don't see interest rates rising in the near future, except the analysts of the major analysts who follow these things. All that's going to happen in the near future is if the economy grows at the rate that it looks like to us it's likely
happening.
To grow.
Right.
In other words, for the rest of the year, I would not be surprised to see a 4% annualized rate kick in.
Even if we see a 3% annualized rate, then we're talking about the same thing.
Then there's going to be a lot of more companies that want to borrow money. As the demand goes up, as companies want to borrow money, interest rates will rise on intermediate-term bonds because that's a supply and demand issue.
There's a lot of money sitting out there that's not had a big demand for it. Mm-hmm. Companies have been filling up their cash reserves. As they fill up those cash reserves, they've got record amounts of cash sitting there. They are now spending that cash to hire people and to increase productivity. It's happening. We're seeing that flow back in the other direction. As that happens, they're going to look around and say, if we want to keep the expansion going, we need to borrow some money. And well, the money that they have sitting in cash is sitting not in a room with paper stacks of money.
It's not?
Correct. It is not. It is not sitting in a room
looking
like paper. It is sitting at a bank somewhere, and that bank has all that cash to loan out. Well, but these corporations aren't going to the bank to ask for loans, so the interest rates are very low. The bank's not going to pay the company a lot of money to keep it on deposit, but it's also going to loan this money out at very low rates.
And
as that money starts drying up, interest rates have to go up too.
Interest rates hit the lows that they hit recently, not based on the recovering economy. Those are fundamentals. It's based on very specific factors that are causing people to delay building projects and a whole host of other things. And the things that have got them worried are mainly Russia.
Yeah.
And this Russia thing is a passing event.
We hope.
Obviously, if all trade with Russia were to be cut off, if Russia were to suddenly shut down, for example, its energy exports to Europe, it would put Europe back into a recession. It might cause the collapse of the euro. It would cause the collapse of Russia, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it would collapse.
Very,
completely.
Very unlikely that Putin will literally blow his foot off. You know, he's come pretty close when he restricted exports, but imports of food. He actually planned that out really well, and it's appealing to the Russians tremendously. He took back some territory and annexed it to Russia, which is incredibly popular in Russia. Eventually, that will blow over. Our economy will continue to recover. And as our economy continues to recover, the demand for money will go up and interest rates will go up. And that's
like physics. It's not something that there's a possible no. If our economy reverses and we have a major reverse, then we won't see interest rates rise. But we're not seeing any of the signs that would say that would happen. We're seeing the opposite. We're seeing all of the forward-looking indicators that are saying what growth is going to be there. It looks good. It looks healthy. It looks like we're building speed slowly. It's not a suddenly slamming the accelerator forward. But that means that interest rates should start rising relatively slowly. Although when you have a market in a bubble like this, the bond market's in a bubble, you might see it happen relatively suddenly. Even though the economy is moving kind of steadily, when people realize, wait, there's the money is being loaned out and I'm not getting in on it, the interest rates are going to jump up. It's just what's going to happen. Does that help at all?
Yes, sir, it does. Wouldn't that be a misallocation of resources, though?
What do you mean?
I mean, as we keep... go ahead, sir.
What did you mean by what resources?
Well, if interest rates are staying low as they are, uh-huh. you're saying that they're going to rise and the economy recovers, isn't those staying those low interest rates keeping... excuse me, I lost my train of thought.
Well, yeah, if you're trying to say...
The low interest rates having a misallocation of resources as the price for money is not...
No, it's not a mis...
It's not included in the interest rate.
It's not a misallocation of resources. It's an assessment of risk. And what happens is if...
Well, if there's low risk, wouldn't there be also more reason to...
But there isn't low risk.
...gamble on investment?
Yeah, there would. The problem is for a corporation to borrow money, they have to do a risk assessment, borrow money to do something. What are they going to do? Let's say they're going to build, Caterpillar is going to build more... manufacturing, let's just use this as a hypothetical, going to build more manufacturing capacity because they anticipate more things being built around the world that they need to sell big yellow monsters to do. And they look over at the fact that Russia might be about to go to war with Europe. And they go, whoa, a third of the money in the world would suddenly dry up that's available to buy big tractors. So they choose not to borrow money and make a big mortgage to build a new Caterpillar bulldozer plant, okay?
As soon as we have resolution over Russia, Europe, Caterpillar goes, oh, well, I'm much more comfortable building a big plant to expand and to allow economies to expand. That's kind of the tripping point.
And if Russia basically cut the energy off to Europe and decided to fully invade Ukraine, and things got cranked up in that direction, there would be at least a temporarily at the very least, Europe would plunge into a severe recession. The United States might go into a mild recession. It would be, and certainly there would be a lot of money that wouldn't go to Africa for a while for where they need to buy bulldozers to build stuff.
Right.
Okay.
On the
like
other,
the Ebola. By the way, the Ebola epidemic is keeping interest rates down
right now. Yeah.
For that reason, because trade between us and African countries and African countries and each other and African countries and China is come to a grinding halt.
Let's take a step further out, though. That scenario, same scenario, Russia's cut off your energy, Europe drops into a recession, Russia invades Ukraine. The end result of that would be the United States taking a very major role in the repatriation of Ukraine, probably. In which case, our economy would go into overdrive, and our exports of energy would go into overdrive into Europe. We would have to take up the difference. We don't have the capacity to make up the difference yet. We're building it. We would have to build faster, which would mean, in that same scenario, loans would have to be made, and that would raise interest rates. When that happens, we're going to see interest rates jump. There's really no way that there's going to be an indefinite period of low interest rates. There's no example of that in history. The closest we could come to it is when a government basically nationalizes the ability for a corporation to fail. That happened in Japan. The big banks were there. This started in the 90s. The big banks are there. And the government said these banks cannot fail. So interest rates stayed low. But that was because the government basically came over and took over the economy. That doesn't happen in the United States, or it hasn't happened since World War II.
Is this making any sense to you?
Oh, yes, there it is. I'm much appreciated. I appreciate
okay.
you guys.
Good. Thank you for calling. You know, one of the things that we think about a lot, and which is probably why we went bald.
Right. Thinking.
Is the interconnectedness of the world. And there's an awful lot of people who don't think about that very much because when they shaped their view of the world wasn't all that interconnected. With just what went on in the United States affected what went on in the United States. But like I said, one of the reasons interest rates are down right now, and they dropped when we thought they were going to go up, is the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa. A lot of investment and raw material go in and out of those countries in West Africa that have just closed their borders. And it immediately has an effect on the markets here in the United States with regard, and we have to look and see, what are those? I mean, are we economically dependent upon Nigeria? No.
Nope. Well, unless you gave your bank account information to the guy that said
yes,
that his
right.
uncle
well,
was a general,
case, right.
then you may be economically dependent on Nigeria.
But a sudden cutoff, which hasn't happened, a sudden cutoff of the oil from Nigeria would definitely have an effect on the oil market. And the Caterpillar, again, our exports, a big piece of our exports in the United States are heavy equipment made by companies like Caterpillar. And we've done really, really well in that area. But I don't think there's a lot of stuff going into that part of Africa right now from Caterpillar because nobody from Caterpillar is willing to go down there and sell stuff at this point for some reason. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Worst and Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could tell me why one communications company would buy the landline business from another communication company. I'll hang up and listen. Thank
okay.
you.
All right. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that.
It's cheap.
It's cheap. They may think that the possibility exists of expanding that business into something else. Landline isn't all about telephone lines anymore. You've also got some types of bandwidth use that go over copper. Fixed telephone lines are probably eventually going to go away completely, but if you think of the companies that are buying those landlines, they're operating on a very thin margin, but they're doing it very, very efficiently. A lot of times what they're buying isn't really the landlines, but the equipment that goes with it. That might help a bit. There's also the bandwidth issue. So there is also, and this is a little bit strange, but if they can pay for it at a low enough price, they can use the expenses to offset gains elsewhere, and that's something that most people don't want to buy losses so that they can offset. But if they pay a low enough money for the initial investment, mm-hmm. then you can use some of the losses that already exist.
What happens is you've got a lot of the companies that traditionally did a combination of traditional telephone companies that are losing money hand over fist because they really didn't move into the new model quickly enough or well enough. And they have some assets that they'd like to sell for whatever they can get for them, including their landlines.
Rights to easements of landlines go with that as well.
Let's just say that you're trying to save whatever Central Texas Telephone ultimately became at some point or somewhere else or whatever. Or you know, and so you're trying to save a company that was a traditional telephone company at some point. And you really need to invest heavily in cellular stuff.
Or in fiber optics.
Or in fiber optics or something like that to recover, to have a hope of saving your company. And you have this big asset sitting there on which you are losing money every month, I might add, in some cases, called landlines. And you said, okay, here's what we can do. We can sell all our landlines and then maybe lease them back from the same company. So, and to give you an example, if a company owns a building that they're in, and I know of one company that actually did this, owns the building that they're in, they needed cash. They didn't want to go borrow it from the bank because the bank was looking at their cash flow situation.
You're saying it's not so good.
No, it ain't going to happen. And let's just use a very round, weird number here that's hypothetical. The building's worth $1 million. And they can rent the building for $60,000 a year, which is a pretty good return on $1 million investment.
Right.
So they could, in essence, sell their building for $1 million, put $1 million in their pockets, and reinvent their company and save it while paying $5,000 a month or $60,000 a year for the rent on the building. Well, over the long term, that would be a really bad idea, but in the short term, that might be the difference between survival and not survival.
All right, now let's look at it from the other direction. The company that's buying the building, which is what the question was, it's only mm-hmm. it's about landline. In order for the selling company to get the money that they want to reinvest in themselves, they're going to have to sell the asset that they have at a discounted price because if you're talking about landlines, everybody can see the writing on the wall. It's not surprised that you're calling in about this. You look up and you say, why would you need a landline anymore? So they're looking at it and saying, why would I buy this unless the rent of the line is going to be enough to fill in for later. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Goat.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.